Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who tied Byron Buxton in games played in center field in 2023. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and that's actually not true. Every baseball podcast tied Byron Buxton.
At least in the major leagues. His seven innings in St. Paul is more than I played in AAA in center field. We are going to talk about Byron Buxton on this January 29th edition of Baseball Barbacast. We are actually pre-recording this on Sunday afternoon since Jake is, as we mentioned on Friday, when you were here in the same room with me, you were traveling across the pond, as they say, and we didn't want to deal with time zones more than we had to, so here we are recording this on Sunday. If we get any news, we will address it accordingly. We are going to talk about Byron Buxton declaring at Twins Fan Fest that he is back in center field, what that means, do we believe him, where we go from here with Byron Buxton. We're going to bounce around the winter ball. We're getting some championship results, talk about that in the Caribbean series coming up. We have a few transactions that happened over the weekend, mostly some relievers, some pitchers, and then we have an extension as well. Colt Keith with the Tigers. We can maybe talk a little bit about that. But mostly we are here to talk about your emails. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Second half of the show is going to be some email responses, catching up on the mailbag. So we appreciate those emails as always as we wait for Scott Boras to find his free agents, the expensive ones anyway, some new teams.
Maybe he's on vacation.
Yeah. Well, I don't know where he went. So we know he was at Adrian Beltre's house.
Yeah.
Where he went from there, who's to say?
Here's a question. Anyway. What time of the year does Scott Boras go on vacation?
Okay, so this is an interesting topic. We've certainly learned as we've started working in baseball about like when baseball people log off. And what is the answer to that? I mean, I guess it's different for people who work for teams versus who work in media. For an agent, I'm trying to think. Probably April?
So for teams, it is like Christmas to New Year's, really? Yeah.
For sure.
But Boras can't do that.
No. No, it's not the offseason. So I think April is my answer if he is actually doing that. But I don't really know. Like maybe like, but I was going to say like, oh, contract extension discussions is bleeding it, but that's not the thing he does. So that's not really an issue. Whereas maybe some other agents, we see a lot of extensions getting done like in the back half of spring training in April. We know that's not happening for Scott, especially once the season starts. Then he's like, especially for his guys, you know, who are a year or going to be free agents at the end of the year, he's like, don't even bother calling. This shit is over.
That's a great point. That is a
I think April's my pick. That's my pick for Scott Boras' vacation.
Enough about Scott Boras. Let us discuss Byron Buxton. Mm. Byron Buxton is a fascinating character in our world of baseball. Second overall pick in the 2012 draft.
Yep.
Wow. I feel ancient. Second overall pick in the 2012 draft, as about as hyped as prospects come. When he was in the minor leagues, we drove across the country to go see him, and he was promoted by like 2 days. We missed him. We talked to scouts at that time, Jordan. I remember it was like Griffey level hype. But really, that's like from the scouting community.
It's an important distinction, though, because he was obviously a big deal as an amateur, high schooler in Georgia, incredible athlete, whatever. But kind of like with Trout. Now, I know Trout was later in the first round, but it was really once he got into pro ball where people were like, holy shit, like, you got to see this guy. Like, as soon as he got to the complex, as soon as he was in A ball, same thing with Trout. It was like, oh my God. Now, in Buxton's case, you know, he went second instead of first. It's not like, oh, how did he not go first? In the way that Trout, it's like, how did he go 25th? But that was the comp. And it was happening also at a sort of similar time, you know, shortly after. And it was just like, oh my God, this dude is a freak of freaks.
And I think that also is because he's kind of from the middle of nowhere in mm-hmm. Georgia. Mm-hmm. This is not Atlanta suburbs. You know, Byron Buxton is from Baxley, Georgia. Buxton is from Baxley. I mean, that's just sounds fake.
Well, and his, well, and I believe his son is named Brixton Buxton, which that one I'll never, as far as a big league, first of all, obviously we can expect that kid to be a great baseball player, but yeah, but Buxton, he is a country boy through and through. This is really from, I don't know what direction or what part of Georgia it is exactly, but it also helped, you know, have kind of the legend, you know. You have to kind of go see him in not exactly the most high-profile of places, high-profile competition. But like I said, in the minors, the legend grew very, very, very quickly because he was the fastest player, basically, in the minor leagues. And he had just absurd, you know, offensive ability on top of that. And he gets to the big leagues by the age, you know, of 21. And it takes a while. You know, the first couple years, it was like, okay, like, you see it, but is he really actually hitting that well? And that was still true even in 2017 when he breaks out, he plays 140 games, still a career high to this day, gets MVP votes, wins a gold glove, but it was a 728 OPS. And you wonder, you'd say, okay, but there's another level here. There's another level. There has to be more with Byron Buxton. And then we start to see it in 2019. In 2020, when he's on the field, 2021, holy crap, it's like, this is it. We've waited all this time. He is one of the best players in baseball. But all the way, the whole time, from the beginning, it is a stop and start situation. The intervals are frustrating, the injuries are mounting, and we just want to see him for more than a few months at a time.
Just a taste. But in 2022, he hits 28 home runs in 92 games. Yeah. While contributing outstanding defense in center field, and we're like, this is it. Yes. 2023 is going to be the year he puts it all together. And the Twins, in a very unique decision, essentially pull Buxton out of center field. And they say, we're going to save his legs, and if he's going to be someone who can hit 28 home runs in 92 games, let's just have him be our DH. And
exactly.
So they say, we're going to DH him all year. And what happens? The offense falls off a cliff.
Yeah. And so then he has bits and stretches where it's like he's kind of finding it, but it wasn't the same thing. Now, again, right, for so long, it was like, well, if he's one of the best defensive center fielders, who cares if he's, you know, striking out a bunch, not walking, the OBP's down, it's inconsistent. It's like, because you know you have that value there. But the fact that they decided, no, this bat is good enough to be a full-time DH, and it almost backfired. And, of course, he gets injured again. He's missing a bunch of time. He comes back and has a rehab appearance where he plays center field in the second half of the season. 7 innings, boom, done, gets hurt again, and then is still rehabbing again to the point where they put him on the playoff roster. Just both extremely cool and also like, what the hell are you doing? Ultimately, he pinch hits at the end of game 4. He's like one of their last outs of the season is Byron Buxton pinch hitting.
They tried to Kirk Gibson him.
Against Brian Abreu, like the best reliever on earth at the time. Like, they were treating it like it was a movie. Like, we love Byron Buxton. Like, that moment, the 30 seconds of him coming out of the dugout and the Twins crowd being like, holy shit, look at this, was so cool. But then it was like, as soon as he steps in the box, it's like, what the fuck are they doing? This is ridiculous. Like, I'm so happy Byron Buxton talks his way into this, but this feels irresponsible.
Now, why are we talking about this now? Because Byron Buxton at Twins Fest, mm-hmm. which we love to fest it up, said that he's back. Asked if he was going to be playing center field. He responded and said, oh yeah, I'm back.
Yes. And he was asked, now that was, I think, like, I don't know if it was a fan Q&A or it seemed like that moment in the FanFest context was like a, you know, let's get the crowd hype. But then apparently the media followed up with him after and he was like, yeah, like I wouldn't have said that if I didn't feel confident that the knee surgery, I don't know what number surgery this is for him, that he had after the season, after his unfortunate pinch hit appearance, that he's fully recovered for that and he's ready to roll. But now here we are again, right? He's entering what is only his age 30 season. And I just don't know what to make of this. Like, I'm always going to be rooting for this guy. But for a Twins team that, again, like, I don't know what their plan would be in center field if it's not him. You know, they have Willie Castro. They had Michael A. Taylor fill in, and he was really solid. But I'm hoping for this. But it does feel like this is now everybody run with it because everybody's rooting for Buxton all the time, right? So, and because it's like we are desperate for anything, every account is aggregating and tweeting like Byron Buxton's back, like it's go time, he's gonna have a huge bounce back season. It's like, listen, I want to believe that too, but like, let's not just forget about what just happened and how it transpired.
It's like a musician where you get legendary singles leaked over the course of a career, but like never the album you're looking for.
It's like, right? Oh, this or, is it. It's totally coming out this year.
Oh, he's gonna drop it. Or for Game of Thrones people who are waiting for the next book, like it. Maybe it happens.
Yeah.
But so, why would I believe in it? I do agree that we are all rooting for it to happen because if it clicks in a season, it could be legendary. And we all want to witness legendary sports performances.
Yeah.
So I struggle to kind of balance those two things, right? The skepticism and the cynicism of why would I believe Byron Buxton is going to be healthy? Mm-hmm. And that's sad, but that's true. Balancing that with, I want to see God in this Chili's tonight.
And also, again, like, it's not what if it clicks. We've seen it click, right? Now he's shown us enough that when it's clicking, but that's what made the first 2 months of 2023 so weird and concerning is that it was like, okay, he was presumably not, but I don't know, maybe he was injured from the beginning again. And then that was what was hampering him. Like, I just don't know what to make of his offensive performance in 2023 when he wasn't playing center field. Like, oh, it's, you could say, oh, well, he needs to be in center field for him to be at his best. I'm like, okay, maybe that's true, but I still have the health concerns. To me, I'm also just like, well, why isn't he playing left field? Like, I don't know. It's just, it's so interesting that this is where we are. We are
because the Twins have been collecting corner outfielders like stamps over the last half decade because they thought that Byron Buxton was going to always be in center field.
Exactly.
I think it's very interesting to look at this within the context of the Twins and the expectations. Last year was really the least value they've ever gotten from Buxton in a season, right?
That's not true because, this is the worst he was while he was playing regularly, I guess is maybe a better way to put it.
That, I guess, is the point. In 2018, he played in 28 games and wasn't very good. But I guess my point is, if for the first time in a long time, it's the least value they got out of Byron Buxton.
That's fair. While he was playing. Okay? Yeah.
While he's playing. And what happened? They won the division. Okay.
And so Carlos Correa sucked too, right? All Carlos the stories Correa you're writing sucked. About Correa and Buxton. It's like, no.
They were not important and the Twins won anyway. Now, is that sustainable? Who knows? But I guess for the Twins, it's like we put the kid gloves on last year. We wrapped him in bubble wrap and it didn't make a freaking difference.
Right.
Okay.
So maybe
if we let him ride and we just have
do
him
it like Ohtani with the Angels. It's like, you know, like fuck it. I'm not going to tell you what to do. If you think you're healthy, you're going to go play center field 150 games if you can. And God bless if it works, great. If not,
if he's Byron Buxton, and I'm sure that there is a part of it where Byron Buxton is saying, in order to be this transcendent offensive force, I need to be in the outfield every day. Sure. It is a real thing. I think for certain players, adjusting to DH is really hard. And so if Buxton believes that, the Twins are like, you know what? Screw it. If he goes out there, in the best case scenario, he plays 140 games and he's amazing. Like, we're going to win 96 games, maybe. Yeah. Right?
Sure.
But if he is usual Byron Buxton in center field, where we get 68 games and he's very good, they're like, okay, sure. Like, that's fine.
Totally.
Whatever. And if he's ass and hurt the whole year, their team is clearly good enough, as we just saw, to compensate for that. And so I think it's kind of a win-win.
Sure.
Which is weird to look at.
They are much better equipped to handle it. Although I will say that from a strictly, regardless of whether Buxton is most comfortable hitting while playing outfield, whatever, like it's not even just about, oh, who's going to play center. It's that they now have, as you just alluded to, they now have several DH options that should be hitting, like, for sure, right? Whether it's Julianne, whether it's Waller, whether it's Kirilloff, whether it's, I mean, you have to consider the fact that one of their top prospects, Brooks Lee, is knocking on the door, is going to make that infield even more crowded. And now we definitely can't be playing, you know, Julianne in the infield or whatever, right? And maybe this changes in the event that they trade Kepler or they trade Polanco or Kepler leaves after this year. Like, there's versions, but it's the other thing is the roster fit does also just work if he is playing center field. And I don't think that they can afford to give him DH at bats, right? Maybe that's the way to put it, in the way that they clearly thought they were going to at the beginning of last season. So really interesting situation. And again, the Twins have made so little news this winter. They have done absolutely fucking nothing.
They knew Joe Mauer was going to get in, and they were like,
that's enough. Which is great, which is great. And they could do that. And again, they did it. They finally won. They won a postseason series. They won a postseason game. Like, the vibes are still pretty good, even with the reporting that they're cutting payroll, whatever, because generally the fan sentiment is in a good place, but they have done nothing, 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 nothing. They haven't even made the cost-cutting moves that we thought. So this makes us think about the Twins, and that's why we opened the show with 15 minutes on it. Anything else on Buxton?
No. Nothing else on Buxton. Let's pivot to a couple of moves that we had.
Let's do that.
Over the last few days. I'd like to begin with Adam Ottavino.
Ooh, sure. Yeah.
Signing with the Mets. How much did you follow this one? This is super interesting.
Yeah. So basically, Adam Ottavino, who was... So I think maybe one interesting place to start with Ottavino is, why wasn't he traded? Why wasn't he traded? Adam Ottavino was not amazing, but like still a pretty decent reliever.
All year.
Like, right? He was healthy. He appeared in 66 games. The strikeouts were down a little bit and the FIP wasn't great, but like he could have been helpful to someone. And for some reason, he wasn't traded. Maybe that is a sign that the league did not value him that high. Maybe it's a sign he's 37. It's like, whatever. But the point is while the Mets traded a bunch of other, you know, people away, he stayed on the team and he had a player option for $6.5 million for 2024, which he declined, which is another sign that Adam Ottavino thought, I have a market. People will want to sign me for more than that.
6.75.
Oh, forgive me. Thank you.
Which, and I know in this context, just a reminder, the difference between 6.75 million and 6.5 million is $250,000, which is a lot of money. So,
Not a rounding error. I appreciate it. I'm usually the one correcting you with numbers like that. So
very true. He declines this option, hits the free agency, and this week signed a one-year $4.5 million contract with the New York Mets. Now, at first glance, that I don't know a whole lot about finance, but $2.25 million less. However, Jordan, what have we learned this offseason? What's been one of the themes of this offseason?
The money is never what it looks when it seems like.
It's not. There are hidden costs and fees. Okay.
Yes, the fine print. No one is reading the fine print enough on these contracts.
Ottavino told Joel Sherman that $4 million of his $6.75 million team option would have been deferred. Mm. And so he's actually making more money now, even though it's less money. I do think it is interesting that he declined an option and then just returned to the same team.
Totally. Also, Adam Ottavino has just been like chilling on SNY like all offseason long, like analyzing other moves. Like he is doing TV. And then I guess at some point he'd be like, oh, I guess I still don't have a team.
I like the idea that he's on SNY just like laying into the Mets. I know he obviously wouldn't do that for a number of reasons.
He gets on there and he's like, this Mets team needs at least one more veteran bullpen addition.
And I would overpay for that. If it were me, I need a beach house.
And one of them who they were reportedly interested in was Hector Neris. And instead they bring back Adam Ottavino for half the cost. Anything else on Ottavino High before we get back to Hector Neris?
I really like Adam Ottavino. I wish him nothing but the best. I think he really likes living in New York. He's from New York.
Oh, for sure.
He grew up here. I think we've reached a point with him where it's New York or maybe retirement. And maybe that's why he didn't get traded, because he was like, I don't want to get traded. Not that the Mets should have cared about that, but...
Right.
I can imagine that for him at this point, my kids are here. My kids go to school here.
Yeah.
Like this is what I want. he trains at the Ottavino lab, which is down the street from me, mm-hmm. Which I still have not been to. Someone sauced me an invitation to that. I need to get on the
I can't decide if that is more of a reflection on you or on them that they haven't invited you yet.
I walk by it every day. I walk by it every single day on the way they train. But who am I? You know, I don't want to sound holier than thou. No, anyway, Adam Ottavino, 1 year, $4.5 million. Good for him. We'd love to see it.
Let's talk about Hector Neris. Hector Neris signs with the Cubs. Cubs, another team that we expected were going to make some moves in the bullpen. You know, early speculation, ooh, could that be a Hader landing spot? Reunites with Craig Counsell. No, they weren't going to spend that much. Cubs bullpen, sneaky okay last year and very anonymous. Very anonymous. And again, that is a sign that your organization is moving in the right direction. When you have a bunch of relievers, if you want to be more like the Brewers, you best be pulling out some 2-3 ERAs from guys you never heard of. And they started to do that in 2023.
And Jordan Schusterman, that is exactly what my point was going to be. The Cubs are giving Craig Counsell the right weapons down there that he will be able to mix and match. The Brewers' success over the last half decade has been, yes, Josh Hader, yes, Devin Williams, but go look at what Joel Payamps last year. Okay.
Trevor McGill. Yeah.
Trevor McGill. You need anonymity in your bullpen. It is very helpful. And now Craig Counsell is going to be able to deploy these pieces. Hector Neris is
not anonymous
at all. He is 17th on the active list for most games pitched.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's been around the block.
He's been the most durable reliever in baseball, basically. Him and Class A last few years, but his goes back even farther. I mean, he basically has not been injured. Injured briefly in 2018, but we're talking seven. He has five seasons of 70 plus appearances and then another one with 68. This dude is, you know, him, the fastball and the splitter. Now, while his ERA was just a career low 1.71, the FIP was two runs above that, right? And so his fastball velo was down, and there were reasons to think, okay, maybe Hector Neris is at least starting to decline. The splitter is still elite. Like, this is still a good reliever. Maybe because he's, you know, entering his age 35 season, it was harder for him to, you know, secure a bigger deal. But is a team an option for 2026 or for 2025 that becomes a player option if he pitches in 60 games, which, as I just said, he's basically done every single season for the last 7 years. So I would expect him to be able to pick that up, unless there's some serious shenanigans involving keeping his appearances down. But I think this is good. I think Neris is, he's not perfect. He has given up some absolutely massive home runs in some inopportune spots, both, of course, with the Phillies and even with the Astros. But he is a much more reliable kind of option. I was thinking about it more in the sixth, seventh, eighth than the ninth, of course. But this does make a lot of sense, I think.
Another Cubs relief move. Carl Edwards Jr., Slender Man himself, the skinny mini, back to the Cubs where he began his big league career, originally drafted by the Texas Rangers.
50th round.
Round that no longer exists, in the 48th round of the 2011 MLB draft out of Prosperity, South Carolina. This will be his 10th big league season. The majority of it was with the Cubs in the beginning of his career. Has bounced around since then. Padres, Mariners, Braves, Blue Jays, the last 2 years with the Nats, where he was pretty solid. I mean, outpitching his fit both of those years, but he's a totally legitimate guy to bring back on a minor league deal. I think he'll end up making the team and get some innings for the Cubs.
Yeah, still can spin the absolute hell out of it. He's basically had elite fastball spin, still throwing pretty hard. And yeah, would not surprise. He's only 32. I mean, again, feels like he's been around forever, but I would not be surprised whatsoever if he and of course, like, everyone fucking loves Carl Edwards Jr. I mean, did he pitch in the World Series? He did. Yeah, he did pitch in the World Series. I mean, I remember him obviously being on that team. But yeah, like, how about that? Carl, you have someone from the 2016 Cubs back on the Cubs. Like, that is a rare occurrence. So I think that'll be cool. That'll be cool.
Bring everyone home.
So yeah, there you go. Good for Carl Edwards Jr. A couple other signings. The Royals signed Adam Frazier. This is exactly, I don't get this one. Even less so than them giving Hunter Renfro 2 years. Like, they have infielders. They have Michael Massey. They have, you know, some other guys. It seems like they just were like, oh shit, we don't have Nicky Lopez anymore. Let's get Adam Frazier. But I don't know. I don't really get this fit. Like, who cares, I guess. Like, what's the big deal? But the Royals are finding, it's like the eighth major league free agent that they've signed, which is, I think, the most in the big league. So in that sense, it's interesting. But I don't know. The Royals are weird, but I'm glad they're making moves.
I think the Royals front office is trying to change history and convince us all that Adam Frazier was on the 2015 World Series team.
Ooh,
because
okay.
Boy, oh, because
it's
boy.
Like that makes sense.
Oh yeah, Adam Frazier was on the 2015 team, right? Like
right,
that
right.
tracks.
Right,
absolutely,
right.
Made a lot of contact. Adam Frazier and the Royals is a match made in naptime heaven. Yeah. He is a consummate professional.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
going to whisper sweet nothings about the grind of Major League Baseball into the ears of Michael Massey mm-hmm. and improve his season by 0.08%.
And most importantly to us, you know, a Mariner and an Oriole, right? Big for the BBQ Immaculate Grid. And by the way, he delivered one of the most important hits of the Seattle Mariners in the 21st century, right? The double against the Blue Jays. So salute Adam Frazier. Good luck in Kansas City. I don't know how much you're actually going to play.
Does Adam Frazier get traded at the deadline? Probably. That is applicable to our next signing. The Oakland Athletics, a Major League Baseball team for the time being, have signed Alex Wood, who spent the last few years in San Francisco. So he's staying in the Bay. He's been with the Giants since 2021.
Okay.
In 2021, he was spectacular for them.
Who was?
I'll walk that back.
He was pretty good.
He was pretty good for them in 21, like a legit starter. I believe he was a member of the 2021 Giants.
Yeah.
That shocked the world. Like, he was their three or their four starter during that season. And then the last 2 years, he has been very unlucky, especially in 2022. He had a 3.7 ERA and a 5.10 ERA and a 3.7 FIP. Last year, a little bit down, but totally good guy for the A's to sign, and maybe they can unlock some things in the first half and trade him at the deadline. I would be shocked if Alex Wood is making starts for the Oakland A's in August and September. Either he's ass and they put him on waivers so they don't have to pay him, or they trade him at the deadline. He's not a member of the next great Oakland A's team. Let's just leave it like that.
No. And honestly, unfair to Alex Wood because he had an awesome career. But to me, he'll just always be the guy that served up the absolute monster Yoenis home run in the playoffs, which was so long ago and so early in his career. But I just, because he has such a distinct delivery and just like kind of look like that, when I think about it, I just think about it delivering the worst pitch ever to our favorite player. So I appreciate it though. Like, appreciate that because that was sick.
Alex Wood looks like Pinocchio is trying to do yoga when he pitches.
That's a good. Is he going to be our opening day starter, Jake?
Probably, and that's a huge upgrade from what happened last year. Where...
they have the young guys like Mason Miller and Joe Boyle, who I love. No, it'll be JP Sears or Blackburn, I guess, is still on the team. So,
woohoo!
Yeah. I am curious to see how much money he's making. I don't think we have a report about the contract yet. Because again, their payroll right now is at $40 million. Okay. I shouldn't laugh because again, it's a disgrace to the sport and it's not the player's fault and all these things.
That's like 0.77 Otani's.
Yeah. Their payroll situation, Aledmys Diaz is making $8 million. He is essentially double the next largest salary. And that's, again, Aledmys Diaz. Trevor Gott, who they signed, 1.5. Paul Blackburn up to 3.5 in ARB, so watch out. Miguel Andujar, who they like claimed on waivers, he's making 1.7. Anyway, Seth Brown. Love Seth Brown. He's still in the A's. Anyway, congrats to Alex Wood. I hope you start opening day. All right, Jake, let us take a break.
Great.
We're going to talk about Cole Keith on Wednesday, or at least I will with Mike Farron. So if you want Cole Keith thoughts, save them because Prospect Barbacast has you covered. We're going to talk about that. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll hit the Winter League stuff briefly before getting into your emails. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbacast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. The winter is almost over, kind of, which means winter ball is drawing to a close. Some of the leagues across Latin America are either in their finals or their finals have finished, which will culminate in one of our favorite events of the baseball calendar, the Caribbean Series, which will take place this year in Miami, yes, which is going to be quite a blast.
Yes, this will be a mini version of what we've seen in the WBC there from February 1st to February 9th. I don't know if there's more teams than normal. Basically, the Caribbean Series is an annual tournament between the champions of all of the winter leagues, which of course headlined by the teams in the Dominican Republic, in Venezuela, in Mexico, in Puerto Rico, but also includes teams from Panama and from Curacao this year, as well as Nicaragua. We've had Cuba has participated in this before. But basically this is, and by the way, like some of these teams will add players who didn't even necessarily play that much in the winter league. For example, Isak Paredes is going to be playing for Mexico, even though I don't think he got a single at bat over the winter. So that's pretty cool. Of course he's already down in Florida. So he's like, yeah, sure. I'll come play for Mexico. Why not? So it's just a really cool event. I believe these games are usually on ESPN Plus. And, you know, we have Tigres de Licey just won their back-to-back championship in Lidom, their 24th title in Lidom history, the most of any team. The Venezuelan finals are ongoing. Cardenales pushed the series to a fifth game. Tiburón is trying to win their first championship since the 80s. That, I believe, is happening on Sunday night. Game 5 is on Sunday night, so it's possible that will wrap up. But anyway, if you have ESPN Plus, if you're in Miami and you want to just go get some fantastic baseball vibes, cannot recommend this enough. There are tickets available, and I'm looking forward to watching those games.
Now, why should you give a crap about this if you don't watch the Winter Leagues during like the Winter League regular season? I guess the good way to think about this is almost like the Champions League in Europe for soccer. Yeah. It's the champion of each of the Caribbean leagues playing one another. The only difference, like you said, is these teams are now just going to draw from the best players in the country that are available and around. And so the Curacao team has Didi Gregorius and Jarlton Simmons, who just retired, Jonathan Scope, Roger Bernardina, Jurickson Profar.
Profar still like an active free agent, right? Still looking for a team.
Vladimir Ballantyne's going to be in this. Mm-hmm. Shea Spitzbarth will be there.
Right, because then you have the guys that, you know, have found, there's all kinds of guys who find their way onto these teams. But like, hey, like Sedan Rafaela, right? A really interesting Red Sox prospect who we saw make his major league debut. He'll be, I imagine, in the lineup for these teams. So it's just a fun mix of names, and adds more, some higher profile names than you will even necessarily see in the playoffs in the actual leagues.
Mexican team, some amazing names. Like you said, Isak Paredes, but Bobby Bradley, wow. Aaron Altair. Mm-hmm. Okay. Odrissimer Despaigne, the legend, the icon.
So there you go. So he's playing. Despaigne is playing because I guess Cuba is not. But yeah, Paredes has not been playing. But like Bradley has been playing in Mexico this winter. So yeah, it's just a fun mix. And I imagine, you know, Miami, I think we've seen it in Venezuela. Recently, we've seen it in Mexico. But I'm really excited to see the Miami crowds there. I'm really curious about that. Obviously, there is significant, you know, diaspora of people who live, whether it is in Venezuela or Dominican or Curacao, that live in Miami. So it should be cool.
Jordan, it's Sunday.
Mm-hmm. It is.
However, there is mail. Let's reach into the mailbag and get to some of your questions. And we will begin with some Cooperstown discussion. This question is from Logan. Logan says, picture this across the United States, specifically Indiana and New York City. Very convenient. Two wormholes open up leading directly to Cooperstown, New York on the day of the induction. There are Todd Helton, Adrian Beltre, Jim Leland, and Joe Mauer. You only have time to ask them one question each before the wormhole closes back up. What question are you asking? Thanks, fellas, Logan. Jordan, do you have any quick thoughts? I've prepped this.
I have one that I would ask. And again, I'm going to add the addendum of like, they have to tell us the truth, right? Like we're basically getting guaranteed an answer from them. I think for both Helton and Mauer, I would ask them like, would you go play football if you knew like you were going to be good? Like not just like you're just going to go play football, you don't know what happens. Like you get to like be an NFL quarterback, but like you were like average, like you were like pretty good, right? But not a Hall of Famer. like which one, because some guys, again, as we've learned with two sport guys, it's like clearly, even if baseball is the smart move, or even if baseball is the better option to getting to certain ways, like, would you honestly prefer to have played football?
Hey, Todd Helton, would you rather have been you or Tony Romo?
Right, exactly. And still Tony Romo now, who like is about to announce the Super Bowl and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, but yeah, that's work.
Yeah, that is work.
You know, Todd Helton gets to kick it in his purple pullover. Here are the questions I would ask, okay? I would ask Todd Helton what he thinks about the current state of the Colorado Rockies.
Yes, be honest. Maybe he showed up at Rockies Fan Fest this weekend and was like on panels, not just like talking about the team. Like he's still around and talking to the Montforts and everything. So, but we want his honest answer.
I want his honest answer. This team has been a catastrophe. They are uninteresting. They are irrelevant. Is he frustrated with the state of play? As Mr. Rocky, is there a way he can save this? I don't know. I don't think so. So that's what I would ask him. I would ask Adrian Beltre, like, what's up with the head touching thing? Like, is there
deeper?
Yeah. Like, it's really never been explained beyond, I don't like it when people touch my head. Maybe the answer is, I don't like it when people touch my head, but I have to think that there is a deeper origin story here. Maybe that's already public. That's probably what I would ask him.
Yeah, I'd be curious about how he felt about, I don't know, it's just so interesting with like, he's clearly so closely tied with the Rangers, right? But it was such a long career before then. And I would love to know about just like the origins of his signing, and if he could have signed with the Rangers, like what do you think about the Rangers before he got there? Like, I don't know. I'm really curious about just like his relationship with Texas in general.
Do you harbor any resentment towards Nelson Cruz
for 2011? Oh, there you go. That's kind of a bleak one, but that is like a, like basically like, how did you actually get over this shit?
Joe Mauer. You're clearly happy. Do you lose sleep because you're 0-10 in the playoffs? And do you wish that you had won a ring elsewhere? You could alter your career. So let's say what was his last season? 18?
Yep.
Let's say Joe Mauer could have been the best pinch hitter on the 2019 Nationals. Mm-hmm. And the rest of his career stays the same. Would he opt into that? He is marring the BREF page, but he has a ring.
Yeah.
Would he want that?
Similar question. If you could play for another team, which one would it have been?
The St. Paul Saints.
Right. If he could have played his whole career in one other, like, you get to have the same thing, but it's on a different team, I would love to know.
The AAA St. Paul Saints.
He's just like Mike Hessman in St. Paul. It's just, that's the dream life for Joe Mauer. But I think that is probably more interesting than like his alternate football career is what, right, where, I mean, could he even, again, could he bring himself to say, because again, oftentimes you have teams, like, I don't sense that this was someone that grew up a Yankees fan, right? We have people all over the country where it's like, oh yeah, I live near this city that you assume I'm like the hometown, whatever, but like, honestly, I was just a Yankees fan. Like, there's like 100 versions of that.
Oh,
I don't sense that, I mean, was like, the case for Joe Mauer.
Can you imagine if Joe Mauer, if we changed history, Joe Mauer was actually grew up a huge Yankees fan?
Right. Oh. Yeah, no, so maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, I would, that would be my other Mauer question. Jim Leland.
My question for Jim Leland is, can I ask you 25 questions about Barry Bonds, please?
So you're asking the genie for more wishes as well.
I'm asking the genie for more wishes, or I'm saying, what was the most memorable cigarette you ever had?
I was going to say, what's the most cigarettes you smoked in one day at a major league ballpark, and why? Like, I'd be curious, again, I don't know anything, like, this is a very much a topic I am not familiar with in terms of, you know, nicotine addiction, like smoking and like stuff like this, okay? But I'm like curious, like, what in his career drove him to smoke more? Like, what kinds of things? Like, I think I love asking when we talk to coaches, like college coaches in particular, like, what pisses you off the most? I love that question. I love hearing, especially, you know, at lower levels where there are more fuck-ups than at the major leagues. But I would love to know, in that vein, like, what pissed Jim Leland off the most?
So I think that is a separate question from the cigarettes, because...
You know, it is, but I'm just wondering if maybe it's adjacent.
Well, I think that maybe for some people, an uptick in smoking could be caused by a particular moment of stress. However, for Jim, it just seems like it was a constant state of inhalation. And so I'm not sure that stimuli would alter the amount of heaters he was puffing in. Anyway, those are the questions we would ask the Hall of Famers.
Great question, Logan.
Great question. Thank you. Thank you for asking us Hall of Famers a question. next question, not really a question, just an email from Josh Foreman with the title Urbanist Kapler. Hello, Jake and Jordan. Loved the Gabe Kapler video talk. I too am pro walking and even pro walking faster, just like Gabe. However, has Gabe Kapler not considered that you can also drive faster? Over short distances, it might not be as easy to shave time off, but it is in fact possible. That is all. L'chaim, Josh.
So, Jordan. We had this discussion after we recorded. You were visiting me. We went on for a while further about the cap thing. And I brought up the same thing as just like, just drive faster, you know? And then we thought about the alternate scenario where, right, he's like, hey, you know, Google Maps tells you that it's going to take you 54 minutes to drive, but have you ever just considered fucking flooring it? And it'll only, you could shave off like 7 or 8 minutes. I think that is obviously the antithesis of the spirit. Because as I mentioned in our original discussion, the clear thesis here is don't get in a car. That seems to be the focus for Kapler. But
don't do it.
I think in theory, you can also just drive faster.
You can just drive faster. Has Gabe Kapler driven a vehicle 100 miles an hour, Jordan? Yes or no?
Has he driven a vehicle 100 miles an hour? Yes. But I'm going to say yes, but not in a long time.
Ooh.
So there you go.
We've never done that.
No, certainly not. Next email. We have a couple emails from just kind of following up on the FanFest discussion. This one comes from Mark. Mark said, heard you guys talking about Beltran being a part of the promotion for the 2020 Mets FanFest. To my memory, Beltran was let go about a week before FanFest, maybe less, and Luis Rojas was hired and introduced the day before this event. I think they had a fan Q&A with Rojas as one of the first events. He was definitely there. Overall, it was a pretty fun day. It was cool that it was at Citi Field. Yeah, go ahead.
Luis, yeah, question. What in the fuck? How about this?
That would be my first question. Mark continues, overall, it was a pretty fun day. It was cool that it was in Citi Field. Would have been better with more space. Tickets were sold for like $20 to season ticket holders, then to the public, three different entry times to limit how many people were in at once. I don't know if that was a COVID thing or a space thing. I assume it was a space thing. I was only get a ticket for the last entry time. Guys like Alonso and DeGrom were certainly gone. The most high-profile player that stuck around chatting was probably Edwin Diaz. I think the funniest part looking back at it was the Q&A with the Mets' new additions from that offseason, and it was Rick Porcello, Dellin Betances, and Michael Wacha, and that was the only time anyone got to see them as Mets in person before the COVID season. So true. I remember so vividly when they signed Betances, and it was like, holy shit, you think like the Severino, the Betances thing almost prepared us for the Severino reaction in some respects. Now, obviously, he really did not do much for the Mets, but I remember that super well that offseason. But that is a funny reaction. So thank you, Mark.
Rick Porcello, his final season was 2020. He did not play again. Is he going to be on the Hall of Fame ballot? He played for 12 seasons. He won a Cy Young. One of the most fascinating careers in recent baseball memory.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Is he... I bet he will be. How many seasons did he pitch?
12.
Yeah, I think he probably will be on the ballot. That's an interesting one, though. Shouts out Rick Porcello. Another follow-up about FanFest from Olive. She says, hi, Jake and Jordan. Just want to let you know that the Cardinals are one of the teams that do both the FanFest and Fan Caravan. They go to 6 different states across the tour. They've been doing them for as long as I can remember. Again, shouts out to these teams in the Midwest. We've seen the Twins. We know the Cardinals. The Reds are rolling into West Virginia and Dayton and all kinds of weird parts of Ohio and Kentucky and bringing prospects you'd never heard of. I fucking love it. Like, this is the other thing that just fires me up about FanFest, too, is just, like, how much people love getting to get a picture with any player, anyone that's wearing a major league jersey, even players that have not been in the big leagues and perhaps will never be in the big leagues. Doesn't matter, because on those days in these random elementary schools, they are wearing the major league jersey and you get to get a picture with them. And I'm not joking. It really like makes me so happy. Like those are the things where I'm like, baseball fans are fucking great.
Because it's also important to remember, right? A team is based in a city. and the team's connection with that city is important. However, in a lot of places, the team's country expands beyond the scope of that city. And so, like, you look at a map of where the Cardinals did Caravan, mm-hmm. and it's like six states, yeah. Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Arkansas, right? Yeah. Like, they're going to Memphis. They're yeah. going, it's a big area, and they're bringing this experience of the Cardinals to communities and areas where there are people who might not be able to afford to drive to all the way 4 hours sure. to put a stadium to pay,
let alone
watch
tickets,
a game.
Right. Yeah.
And so I think it's great. More Caravans. Jordan, we should do one of these.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's again, and the Orioles one that we're seeing just like brings me so much joy. Like, and again, we talk about this, just the combination of players that they send out. Like, I would love that job if I worked for a team and I worked in marketing or whatever, those community events, getting to pick which players go to which library and which fire station and whatever, like all of those. It's just great. I love the FanFest stuff. And it all makes me very happy. So anyway,
I'm gonna
for following up about that.
Tommy Edman, we'll see you at the farmer's market in the Ozarks.
Yes. Shouts out to them. Our next email comes from Cole. Cole says, "Hey, Jake and Jordan, hope you guys are doing well." We are doing well. Thank you, Cole.
Yep.
To fill the baseball void in the offseason, I will typically get really into cricket. Same, Cole. And
not me.
Differences...
Not me. I cook and hang out with my fiance.
Wow, that's sick, bro. That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, big wife guy.
One of the key differences, you're not married yet. One of the key differences between baseball and cricket is how many balls are used in any one match. In test cricket, the same ball is used for at least 80 overs or like 500 pitches. And even then, a team can choose to keep the aged ball. Bowlers will specialize in differently aged balls. It becomes a major factor in the strategy of the match. An aged ball will generally favor slower bowlers who rely on spinning the ball to bounce off the ground in unpredictable ways. Players will also rub the ball only to one side to give it more mid-air movement as it ages. When a fan catches a ball at a cricket game, they throw it back to the players immediately. This is definitely true, and it always makes me laugh. Anyway, thinking about how this made me think of one big question. How would baseball be different if teams had to use the same ball throughout the entire game? How hard is it to even throw a used baseball? And this is where Jake Mintz, the former baseball player, can tell us. MLB pitchers will get a new ball as soon as the old one touches the dirt. I always assumed it would become impossible to grip. Would some pitchers specialize in new versus old balls like in cricket? What implementations would make for the best entertainment? Would you keep the pitch clock or just hope that the fans throw it back within 20 seconds? So many great questions. I do love this because I think this is something that I've seen, you know, Sam Miller write about. Like, players and pitchers like are ditching baseballs faster than basically ever before. Like, we're chucking, like, I think for a while you would have guys like, I've heard stories very classic of like Greg Maddux being like, no, like, I'm using that fucking ball for four innings or whatever. Like, do not get rid of that. And when we've heard pitchers that we've talked to who do not want to get rid of the ball because, again, it can help. But what is your player perspective of this?
So my first thought is that we did this from 1850, whatever the hell, to 1920. Mm-hmm. And that was shitty. The dead ball era comes from
this was part of the problem.
It was the deadness of the ball. Okay. So I think that there are two. I'm not a scientist. I don't plan on becoming definitely. One. Definitely not. In my mind, there are two stages of ball aging. Okay. Mm-hmm. You get a ball, and then as it gets kind of scuffed up and used, it becomes easier to throw as a pitcher, right? There are various little notches and grips within the cover of the ball that you can utilize. If the seams are scuffed, that's really helpful. If one side of the ball is like shinier than the other, or smoother than the other, or rougher than the other, that can, you know, impact ball flight if you're throwing it hard enough or with a certain amount of spin. But then I would imagine that it becomes even more helpful. Like, if you use the same ball for like eight innings and it gets really gross and dirty, I would imagine it wouldn't fly as clean through the air, because ball flight through the air, like, I'm thinking about aerodynamics, right? Cyclists shave their legs so that they can move through the air. The slicker
swimmers.
A ball, the more it's going to carry. If I use a ball the more I use a baseball, like, the less it's likely to fly. Now, at the level that I played, we all sucked too much to know and utilize the differences here. I played for 4 years. I didn't know a single person who used any sort of tack or grip or anything. Right. Now, maybe we were goody two shoes. I don't know. But I would say that if you never changed out of baseball, home runs would go down a lot.
Yeah. And what, like, the trade-off that for pitchers, it's like, okay, the scuff means I can control it and I know it's going to cut this way or this way. But ultimately, the trade-off is presumably, as he sort of hints at in the email, is command, right? And at some point, you know, it's funny because in cricket, I'm thinking about like the importance and value of command and control, right? You can't, I mean, yes, you can do a bad throw to where they get a free hit, but like, it's not the same thing as like walks in the way that like, if you just can't fucking throw strikes, you're really in a bad place in baseball. And that's why guys are probably wanting, you know, a fresh pill pretty consistently. I also think this is an interesting question in the context of the fact that pitchers continue to complain about this anyway, even when they are getting new baseballs all the time and saying that, oh, these baseballs, this grip sucks. And this, these kind of like that is still, it is still a real discussion point. So how it would impact it if you were using the same ball over and over, I think is really interesting. But I also imagine that like the scuffs and whatever for a baseball, especially when you consider the seams, are going to be drastically different than that of a cricket ball. So that probably also makes a pretty big difference. But great question. I love it. And I think about it all the time. Like, it is so funny. I've wondered what would happen in cricket. Like, if you do keep the ball, like, are they going to scorch you out? Like, but they throw it back so fast in cricket. It is hilarious.
Other countries are kinder than us. Two more questions. Yes. One from Adam. I was listening to the January 24th episode congratulating the Hall of Famers, and an offhand comment jumped out at you. Sorry if it jumped out and scared you, Adam.
Ooh,
during both the Beltran and Hell discussions, one of you guys, probably Jordan, said something to the effect of, and also important for a Hall of Famer, he was never bad. This jumped out because I thought, yes, exactly, and I don't hear this much in the general Hall of Fame discussion. It's usually some conversation around peak versus longevity with awards and postseason as sweeteners. So my question is, how much does or should he was never bad matter for Hall of Fame consideration? How many truly bad seasons can a Hall of Fame player have? Does it matter how old he is when the bad season or seasons happen? Does it matter if he bounces back to previous productivity? Yes, it does. I'll just say that. It definitely matters if they bounce back. Like, if a dude has a down year in the middle of a career and then figures it out, that's fine with me. Is one especially atrocious season enough to tank an otherwise solid or borderline candidacy? I would say yes, because how much should we hold Andrew Jones's 2008 season against him? I would say a lot. Does his 62.7 career war afford him less leeway and respect than Pujols' 101.5 war does? Yes, it does. Or does none of this matter as long as the bad years don't pull a player's overall numbers down below our Hall of Fame standards? Signed, a Dodgers fan who struggles to see Andrew Jones as a Hall of Famer after sitting through that season. Okay, you love this question.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, as we're coming off the Hall of Fame discourse and as we're looking ahead to the kinds of Hall of Fame discussions we're going to have about shorter careers with great peaks, like, it does feel relevant. It came up when we talked about Posey, how for him to finish like he did was so amazing. Again, for Pujols, right? What if Pujols hadn't had that last season? And he, of course, he's getting Hall of Fame anyway. But I'm just saying that, like, guys who are more borderline cases as he's bringing up, I think it is interesting. And especially when you are the fan of the team where you saw him when he sucked ass, I get it. It's like, that's not a Hall of Famer. It's also interesting because sometimes, especially with pitchers, it's like, well, he got hurt, his velocity vanished, and is that his fault? Is it not? In Andrew Jones's case, like, the dude basically stopped trying for multiple seasons and then never came back, right? And that's something that you can kind of hold against him in a more real way, in the way that, like, if you look at a David Wright or you look at a Felix or even, you know, someone like Utley, right? Utley was not very good for the last few seasons of his career. And in some stupid ways, it almost diminishes the peak. But also, I don't know. I think it is going to be very case by case, but I think this kind of context will probably come up more as we talk about players. But I know you kind of took this in a slightly different direction.
Well, I just want to say, okay, good example. 2014 Justin Verlander with the Tigers. He's 31 years old. Okay. He has already won a Cy Young and MVP and finished second in a Cy Young. His 20s are incredible. He comes out at age 31, a year where he should still be good, and posts a 4.54 ERA in 200 innings. Now, his FIP is a little bit better than that, but the stuff is down and the strikeouts are down. He leads baseball in earned runs allowed. Okay, this is supposed to be his peak, and it is not. And it takes him a little bit of time to kind of recapture Justin Verlander's Justin Verlanderness, and he does, and then he rebounds, and now he's, you know, one of the greatest pitchers of a generation, no conversation at all. I am impressed by that. I am impressed in some ways by a mid-career valley that a player is skilled and talented enough to climb out of. However, there's also something about the end and beginning of career slide that I find boring because it's basic. Okay, so you have the Mike Trout or Aaron Judge first half season in the big league scuffle, where we cannot say that Mike Trout was never bad. And maybe that is unfair, but he came up in 2011, played 40 games, and was bad. Like, he was a bad big leaguer. Since then, pretty good.
Goat.
Okay. Pretty great.
Right. Right, right. I would say, like, my biggest takeaway is that, especially because this was the context that it came up in, I like using it more in a reverential sense than in a, that's why that guy shouldn't get in. Right. And I understand why he's bringing up Andrew Jones. And I think that's super fair. And, like, that is an interesting part of it. But it is also a reminder of, and I think I wrote this when I wrote the Helton piece originally, like, so much of Hall of Fame discourse now is like, why shouldn't he get in? Like, that is really where we start the conversation with so many of these players that are not Adrian Beltre and not, you know, the obvious guys, is why they shouldn't. And so that's why we jump to that compared to, I just think it's like, that's why he was one of the greatest players. That's why he should be, you know, in Cooperstown, because you mentioned whether it is someone bouncing back from a mid-career, you know, shitty season, or someone that somehow manages to end up at the top at the end, like a Posey, like a Pujols, that kind of demonstrates their greatness. But even like a Mauer, where, like I said, he wasn't bad. he aged gracefully. He did not fall off a cliff at any point. And that, I do think, is something that you can credit in a way that Utley was bad at the end, right? And that's where you say, okay, the difference between Utley and Mauer, is it that big of a difference? Utley's got more WAR, whatever. The peaks are similar. Okay, but like, we saw Utley be a not very good player for multiple seasons in a way we didn't see from Mauer.
It's also like not letting yourself go.
Yeah. Which, again, that's we'll talk about with Hanley Ramirez next year. Like, you can find a lot of players where it's not even necessarily injuries, where it's like, that dude was a Hall of Famer. And if you really want to argue, you could say Felix, right? Like, there's some indications that there is some part of that too, but I think that's a slightly different discussion. But either way, like, there are a lot of players like that where it's like, damn, he sure looked like a Hall of Famer, and then not so much.
I just fell down a Mike Trout rabbit hole as we're talking about,
man,
him.
Whoa, he's
so
guy's pretty good.
Mike Trout has the same number of steals since 2020.
Yeah. Mike Trout's done running.
As Jared Triolo.
Yep. Yep. People are like, who?
As Shin-Soo Choo. Mike Trout and Shin-Soo Choo have the same number of steals since 2020.
Well, he got hurt on a steal, right? He broke his thumb. I don't even remember what year that was. And then that was pretty much game over. Mookie Betts is also just done stealing bases. There are just players who are just decided, like, no, okay, we're done with this. We're not running anymore.
He has fewer steals than Daz Cameron.
Because, by the way, Mike Trout, still fast. He has not gotten slower. That's not the issue. Even though you would assume he has gotten slower, he's had lower body injuries too. He's gigantic. He's getting older. No, he's still, I don't know what his, he's been above 90th percentile sprint, I believe, every year of his career. So,
just one more steal than Yadier Molina since 2020. There you go.
Damn. Salute. Mike Trout. That'd be funny if, like, he, that now that he's back, I don't know what the hell to make of him. He's just going to be the best DH in the league, and he's going to hit 50 homers again. Like, it's, here's the take. It's more likely that Mike Trout hits, when I say 60, I'll say 50 home runs in a season than he steals 10 bases in a season.
Yeah, that's a great bet. That's a great bet. All right, we've reached the hour mark. Let's tap it out, Jordan. We're out of here. Thank you all for listening.
Yeah, you said there were two more emails. So if you're listening, you'll just have to wonder. Maybe you were that last email that we didn't get to read.
Damn.
You can email us at baseball.
Sliding doors moment.
at gmail.com. Thank you to producer Chris for putting this together. We'll be back on Wednesday, likely just me and Mike Farron, and then hopefully later this week. But stay tuned. A lot of stuff going on, Jake Mintz. Just going to leave it at that.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, thanks for listening. We love and appreciate all of you. And we'll talk to you all very soon.
Bye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.